what was my favorite part about it? Going on missions. And I wish somehow, some way, I could let others feel that feeling of getting on, whether it's a little bird or Black Hawk helicopter in the middle of the night with 9 of the most prolific killers America has to offer, and taking off under NODs, going to visit one of the worst terrorists in the world, knowing that this is his last night on Earth, and you are going to be the reason that is.
Hey guys, welcome to this episode of the Street Cop Training Podcast. I'm your host, founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Benito, and we have with us today Brent Tucker, First Responder Coffee Company, Special Forces, amongst other things. I will let you give them your bio because I'll probably fuck it up as I usually do, and I don't want to do that to you because you are inherently a nice guy right off the dick, and I don't want to disturb that.
Great. I love talking about myself. 20-year career in the Army, joined after 9/11. First job I got into, I knew it wasn't for me. So I joined after 9/11 specifically to do something in retribution, for that atrocity. So it took me until about 2003 to realize that I want to be a Green Beret, and that's where the action's at. Spent almost 8 years as a Green Beret, bouncing back and forth from Afghanistan and Iraq, and spent the last half of my career in the Delta Force, going around the same countries and added a few countries onto that.
Dude, Delta Force is, I don't know if people know the intensity and how hard it is to make that Delta Force. And I have to give credit where credit's due. If I didn't listen to Goggin's second book, I wouldn't know that. But tell me about that a little bit.
Did Goggins talk about in his book going to selection?
Yes.
Oh, did okay. Goggins was a visitor in West Virginia to our selection process. Didn't make it, unfortunately.
I think he said that as well because he screwed up navigation or some shit like that.
Yeah, and I don't know him personally. What I do know about him, he is a machine. No, I don't think anyone's going to take that away from him. But it is a classic, type of case where we're looking for the whole man concept. Yes, you have to be a stud, but we're looking for problem solvers, people who can think on their feet, or think when they're tired and hungry, which not everyone can. We start really putting the screws to them. So yeah, it is definitely, like I said, I would agree with that in the most humble way. I don't think people realize what a small percentage of special operations end up at a tier one unit. It is a very, very small percentage.
So there are different tiers. Maybe you can shed a little light on this for some folks.
Yeah, absolutely. Within special operations, there's tier one, and really everyone else is tier two or three below that. To be honest with you, it doesn't really matter if you're tier two or tier three. Everyone below that is the same. There's only true 2 tier one elements, SEAL Team 6 and the Delta Force, both through their hostage rescue focused mission. Obviously, that's just that type of mission set requires focused training and a lot more training and resources to do it properly and do it right. And then everyone else is tier two or below. And like I said, it doesn't matter who you are. It'll offend some people or some fans, but the guys in those units will know because it's just a fact. So, whether you be a Green Beret, a Ranger, a Navy SEAL, a Marine Raider, none of those units are tier one. And those are the units that we recruit from to come up to tier one.
What did you like the most or love about the Special Forces tier one Delta Force, which is fucking awesome, dude. So, and by the way, thanks for fucking all your service, bro, because you're so much tougher than I am. Let's face facts.
I can, first of all, thank you. Thanks for saying that. I can tell you without a doubt, it's not even hard. What was my favorite part about it? Going on missions. And I wish somehow, some way, I could let others feel that feeling of getting on, whether it's a Little Bird or Black Hawk helicopter in the middle of the night with nine of the most prolific killers America has to offer, and taking off under NODs, going to visit one of the, you know, worst terrorists in the world, knowing that this is his last night on Earth, and you are going to be the reason that is. Just it's addicting, and nothing else in my life will ever fill or replace the adrenaline of doing those raids.
Dude, no question about it. I just tell you, you triggered something in my mind, a funny story. So one of our instructors here, his name's Sean Grogan, and he teaches body language and behavior analysis and all that shit. But he was a Marine, and he was the invasion of Fallujah. So I got him, I don't know if I got him his last couple of weeks of field training as a when he was a cop, but I at least had him when he was brand new. He didn't have a year on the job, and I got him in his first pursuit. I think the first night he wrote me, whether he was still in field training or that he became my partner, I was taking him under my wing because I liked him. And he got in the first pursuit. I never forget after the pursuit. He's like, bro, I haven't felt adrenaline like that since we invaded fucking Fallujah. He's like, that shit was legit, yeah, dude. And I got to tell you, on a much smaller scale, pursuits as a cop. Oh, Brent, they're fun.
I believe that. I still try to go on ride-alongs about once a quarter. I help out with the local SWAT team here in the Orlando area. And I still go on ride-alongs with those guys that are on the full-time team. And I enjoy it. It's awesome.
Bro, I can't imagine what it's like to be, like, I think a lot of people who listen to this podcast have adventure in their blood. I think that's why a lot of us take police work as a profession. My friend Tim said to me one time, we had some crazy storm kicking off, right? It's raining, the fucking creek, everything's overflowing, and it's a fucking nightmare. And my friend Tim said, isn't this the most fun time to be a cop? And I go, yeah, dude, I'm like tying rope around my waist and wading into waters to rescue Labradors. And like,
yeah,
he's like, isn't this the fucking best? And I'm like, dude, it is. Like, I just fucking, this That's is right. the best shit, dude, to have a good time. You know, I had a blast. So much fun. And I think that's why we deal with it or the bullshit, because the job is really fun and really challenging at times. And again, I'm not trying to compare it to being a tier one operator, but
I don't take it that way at all. The human psyche is good in this aspect that generally speaking, it forgets the bad times, but hangs on to the good times. So it's why you look back on our career and you look back on how great it was. But you know, you kind of tend to forget all the bull crap that you dealt with, but I'm glad it works that way.
We had, I wonder who, let's see, who was it? Somebody's on recently. And oh, okay. We have, right. Nick was on recently. He was a Navy SEAL. And I said, tell me something that people don't know about Bud School that maybe something really fucking strange. And he said, you're in the ocean all the fucking time, and there is no better feeling than when your friends piss on you to try to just warm you up for a second.
I knew immediately for warmth.
Yeah. He's like, dude, he's like, when you feel somebody else's urine, it's the most refreshing thing. You got anything like that?
It's a fleeting warmth. It was like that for dive school or just doing like dive missions. I get that. But a lot of things we do, I'm really, even in special forces, even to the unit, our selections are very different. They're very much individually driven. And then our training courses after that are team driven. But Buds, you know, puts a strong emphasis on teamwork right off the bat. So there's a lot of things you do as an individual during those selection processes. But yeah, I can't think of anything really strange other than just like your standard hallucinations, you know, that happen when you get so tired and been going for so long. You see some weird stuff. You see some people act really weird.
How do you dig past shit like that, dude? How do you get to that point and just where do you find yourself in that last bit of energy that you're fucking just running on fumes?
I think that's at the end of the day, I really think that small portion is you're working so hard to get to someone to that level. So it's kind of like working out, right? Say you work out for an hour, but that last 5 minutes of your workout is where you want to be. So if you could just skip to that last 5 minutes of that absolute, you know, exhaustion and pushing through. That's where your gains are, you know, are made. Same thing with that. I think that's where you have to push them to that level to see who they're, what they're really made of. Cause I think everyone deals with it, or everyone has it, but you deal with it in different ways. So you either have the internal fortitude to say, no, that's, you know, that's not where I'm going to let my mind wander. And I'm going to, even though you're seeing things and dealing with things that everyone else is, that's just finding the guy who's wired right to not let his brain go there.
What did you know about yourself before you went in, and why you, this type of work and mission attracted you?
That's an interesting question. Cause what, it's almost a reverse. It's not, I didn't confirm what I knew about myself, before the military. I was very risk adverse as a kid. I didn't ride roller coaster rides. I didn't like heights. I didn't do things that were like really dangerous, per se. I did like racing cars, like the quarter mile drag strip, but that was, yeah, it's a very safe thing to do, like, you know, generally speaking. So I wasn't necessarily much of a risk taker, but like a lot of people, I thought that was the, like, I always thought like, hey, you know, had, I didn't get into a lot of fights, you know, but I always felt like, yeah, if I was pressed, that's the kind of man I thought myself to be. But yeah, there's a lot of people who think that they're, you know, that particular type of man. And it's very gratifying to go through that and prove to yourself, hey, just because I wasn't tested yet, yes, that is the type of person I've always been. I just needed the opportunity to get tested and prove it. And more important than that, it's not just the getting tested, it's proving the type of man you are to prepare for that test. That's where we separated men from boys, who showed up prepared. And then after that, you know, it only separated more after that.
Do you think people that you went to high school with, or who knew you as a child, would have had you pegged for going Delta Force Tier 1 operator?
No, I get it all the time. I was undersized as a high schooler. When I was 16, I was probably 5'3".
Oh shit.
And probably, you know, I don't know how much I weighed, but it wasn't impressive, whatever it was. I grew a couple inches every year, but by the time I was a senior, I may have graduated 5'8". But I've continued to grow a couple inches every year, even after high school, until, you know, I finally hit 6 foot. And I tried so hard to put on weight my whole, you know, high school time, by eating all I could, working out as hard as I could. Just the genetics just weren't ready, and we're never gonna, you know, just, there's nothing you can do about that. And the truth is, I am so glad. I was a very athletic kid though, even though I was you know, undersized, and it made me work twice as hard to do what other kids could naturally do. And if I could go back, I would not change a thing. It really made me who I was. And then eventually, you know, I got that work ethic was set because of that.
It's funny as you say that, my number three is a runt, but he's got the heart of a lion, dude. And he just does. And he's got no shame in his game.
You know, funny that the correlation of that is, and again, yeah, I talk about, you know, selecting the right person, being wired right. You know, it's not just your physical, you know, attributes, although they have to be there. Not everyone perceives reality in combat, and this is the same, and I'm sure law enforcement will understand this. You have to perceive the reality of your situation, and some people get it and some people just don't get it. And I don't really know, it's something you can't train for, and it's even harder to assess for, but you know it. And I'll give you an example. Just because a guy is fearless and, you know, and runs into a house, but if he didn't understand the danger that he was going into, I don't know if that's fearless, because you didn't know good enough. You didn't know enough to be afraid of the situation. That doesn't make you brave. And the reverse of that is still true. Like, you know, if you think everything is out to hurt you, and you're in some huge danger, and you can't move the way you need to move, you know, you won't contribute to the team. So just being able to find the right person who can assess the situation, but assess it accurately, to decide when they're going to take a risk, when they're not going to take a risk, and how fast they can assess that and move. And it's huge. And I have that with my kids as well. I have one kid that I thought was brave, but I think she just doesn't always understand the risk she's putting herself in. But she's a beast, and I love her for it. But those are attributes that, you know, to some degree in law enforcement and military, that they're traits that follow them the rest of their life. And when done right, they can be a huge benefit to the team or the opposite.
I actually love what you said, and I'm going to think about that a lot. It correlates to a saying that I have, but I'm trying to think if it's the same. And I've said it before in the podcast, and I'll say it again. And actually, the Street Cop Survivors Club, which you'll see those guys in Nashville. So guys, if you don't know, Brent Tucker is going to be the fucking Nashville conference. I'm fucking pumped. I didn't know you're coming, bro. I'm fucking so excited. And I just want you to know that, like, it's going to be chaotic, and I'm going to hug you and kiss you on the lips, and I'll catch up with you in about an hour.
Okay.
And I don't want to seem like I'm rude, but it is going to be chaos. You know, 1500 plus people, day one and day two especially, dude. Yeah. They already bother me enough here. The 19 people that work in this office, then we'd have like 35 people there who are working with us, bothering me nonstop. We have a lot of shit to do, a lot of stuff to work out, and a lot of the stuff actually gets done day one. But our Street Cop Survivors Club is a group. It's a Facebook group, but essentially it's more than a Facebook group of men and women who were significantly injured in the line of duty, and that typically means through horrible car crash or being shot. Typically, most people are, and it's not saying you need that to happen to qualify for the group, but a majority of people in the group have been shot. And I created a shirt for them. They're going to be selling, and because we have a nonprofit now that supports the men and women in law enforcement who essentially were shot in the line of duty or significantly injured, and what we're trying to do is create a kind of like a unique response to them, where when it happens, we can provide some support in many different ways. It's hard for me to reveal what that is yet because the semantics of it haven't been worked out. But the back of the shirt, they wanted to have my phrase that they've heard over and over again on it. And I'll actually show it to you before we wrap this thing today. And the phrase is, although I have fear, I am not afraid. So I think that really kind of encompasses what you said as well. Like, yeah, I'm fucking scared, but, you know, I can't let that dictate my decision. I can essentially acknowledge that the fear is here. There are some consequences, some risks.
There's no success without risk. And I don't care if that's on the battlefield. I don't care if that's in business or just in life. Hopping on that job is no guaranteed of success. There's always risk involved. But in the day, I will bet on myself that if it doesn't work out, then I'll figure something else out as well. But I'm just not going to play it safe my whole life. You'll get play it safe prizes as well. And just think, you know, for the generally speaking, you know, guys like me and you and even her, because she did it, are willing to take that risk.
You'll be surprised when those non-playing it safe surprises and prizes show up in your life, because sometimes you'll feel like you're getting beat up and beat down and maybe like, I don't know if this is worth it. And then out of nowhere, something fucking amazing happens. Just amazing.
You know, speaking of fear, I got a chance to go shoot with Tim Tebow, you know, arguably one of the greatest college athletes to ever play the game. And after we got done shooting, we were having dinner, and the thing he was interested in the most, he goes, "Hey, were you nervous before missions? Were you how'd you deal with the nervousness? How'd you deal with did you think about failure? What'd you think about you could tell." It was very intriguing to him. The psyche before the big game was, you know, was something he was very interested in that on other levels. So we talked a little bit about it, and I asked him, you know, I was like, how'd you deal with, hey, at the end of the day, at least there's not a million people watching me, you know, if I mess it up. I said, were you nervous before games? And he's like, man, on that bus ride to the stadium, I was almost so nervous I could throw up. Just, and that's all you could think about was, you know, was messing up. And so it is odd, and it doesn't matter who the person is. It correlates all the same, whether you're, it's just human nature. Like, fear will always be there, but you can't, you can't play afraid.
So how nervous were you?
Generally speaking, on the ride out there, I could fall asleep on the helicopter to the mission. I just not worried at all. You get woken up, or at least kind of start moving to the sides of the helicopter at 6 minutes. So at 6 minutes to target, now you have the other 5 minutes to really think about this is happening. What you thought was going to happen is now about to happen. In your mind, you start going, okay, this is where I'm going to land. It's in the middle of the night. It never looks the same when you hit the ground. Everything always looks closer. Everything looks confusing because you're looking at a map from the top, and now you're in a 3D model of it in real life. You're not looking at the rooftops of everything. And you start wondering, am I going to go to the right house? You know, as soon as we land, is this village going to erupt in gunfire like it does sometimes? And all these kind of the same thing that Tim was talking about. That is my bus ride. That 5 minutes of quietness, waiting. That were really close to target. And then you get the 1 minute call. With the 1 minute call, you start to kind of the area you studied, you start to recognize it. And you're like, okay, I know where I'm at. And then by the time you get the 30 second call, like before you land, you're only worried about where there's no there. That was my kind of afraid time. And I'd get sometimes so nervous that some missions you just know are going to be bad. Everything's just stacking up that way. I'd get even shaky, nervous at times. I don't want to die. I don't want to leave my kids fatherless. But you get the 30 seconds out. The only thing I would concentrate is, cliches is my job. And I wouldn't worry about anything that could go wrong. I was only worried about what my job was as soon as I got off that helicopter. And when the wheels touch down, everything just moves so fast. The operators at the unit are just, they're just so good at what they do, and they move so fast. You're just on autopilot, kind of keeping up. By the time it's all said and done, it's definitely too late at that point to be afraid. So that's kind of like the emotional roller coaster of a flying to target.
What's it feel like when you're flying out of target?
Oh, well, as long as everything went good, high fives, big smiles, and waiting to go back to the campfire to hear all the stories about all the things that happened on target that you didn't see. Those are some of the funniest times, just hearing things, guys did, or maybe they tripped on something. or maybe they opened a door and it was too late, and who knows? They did a flying jump kick into some innocent guy's chest who just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time. There's always shenanigans for the guys who, when it's game time, are probably, obviously some of the most prolific killers and just serious as can be. As soon as the job's done, they're also some of the funniest people I've ever been around.
So how do you think of death? No, you faced it so many times, inevitably.
There's two answers to that. I've buried a lot of teammates, and friends, and it's part of it. And when it happened, to be honest with you, I never let it completely control me, like, oh, that could have been me. It could always be you. Like every day it could be you. It could be you in training, tomorrow when we work through explosives or jeopardy airplanes. I really never did think about, death, to be honest with you, a whole lot. Other than that small window on the helicopter when it's like you're about to really put yourself in this situation. Outside of that, it's not something. I have a finite amount of time, and I'm not going to devote any of my time towards that because it's just not beneficial. When you're training to be and executing at the highest level in the world, which is what the Delta Force is, it's not beneficial to me or my teammates to sit there and think about all the bad things that might happen. So it's that easy. I just choose not to.
You have four kids, and I can hear how much of a devout father you are. in just speaking with you, and, you know, I think it takes one to know one, right? Most of us just are obsessed with our children and are proud and just enjoy them. Flaws, strengths, weaknesses. We just, all of it, you can't get enough of. So when you're with your kids, how thankful are you that you weren't one of the ones that unfortunately lost their lives and you survived and got to spend this time with your children?
And I said, hey, well, there's two answers to that. And this is the second part. You know, when, you know, the last unfortunate incident we had was John Dunbar in Syria, and Matt Tunro was on that mission as well. A British SAS guy. All those are open source information. It's not spilling any secrets. You can Google it. When my kids started, my kids have been to more funerals than any kids should have to go to. But when they started being old enough to realize it and realize like this is what daddy does, and my kids, you know, they were old enough to know. I got shot up one mission and had to get evacuated back to the States to save my life. And, you know, my kids are visiting me in the hospital, and it's hard to not think about that when that's their world and that's the world they're in because of you. When I was still operating during those funerals and, you know, those times, I thought about it a lot, you know, but, you know, those were the times to stop and think about, you know, where you're at in life and kind of reflect. I thought about it a lot then, but after that, you know, you have to push it, you know, bury it deep and push it in the back of your mind and just not go there and think about it, because it's just not beneficial. Now that I'm out, and I don't have to do that anymore, there are definitely times I go do things with my kids that I wouldn't, because there was a time in my life where that wasn't an option for me to do it. And now that it is an option, you know, how selfish would it be of me to be, even though I'm tired, to not do something with them that I could? And I think that's partly because, you know, of the kind of life and death job that I had, and that I won't take the time I have for my kids for granted.
Do you think that they have a great sense of relief knowing that the father's retired, and have they expressed that to you?
My oldest for sure. But I don't know at one point they'll realize it. They knew dad was in the Army, but I don't even, my kids don't have a, we talked about it already once. Most of America doesn't have a firm understanding of what the Delta Force is. My kids don't. But I think it's not something I talk about a lot, you know, to be honest with you. That's something I'll always be proud of. But, you know, I closed that chapter of my life. It's not who I identify as. It's not who I am as a person. It's a job I did. It's a job I'll always be proud of. But, you know, now I have another goal in life with, you know, First Responders Coffee Company, which is literally, you know, raising money for first responders. And speaking of death, you know, Mike Melmerstadt, an Orange County SWAT guy, just, you know, passed away last week. And we immediately were able to donate money towards that. And continue to donate, you know, through, we have, you know, gun raffles going on and the connections we made through the community. You know, being able to be there for other families going through it, knowing what that's like and what it means, just gives you a new purpose. And so we're glad to be a part of that.
I think you kind of touched on this a little bit, but I did want to ask this question formally and get a formal response. Do you think that you have a greater appreciation for life and for being a father to your children after living the life you've led thus far? Probably more than most people.
100%. There's a trying to think of a way to, you know, to encompass that, you know, and dive into that answer. But I don't know if I'll do it justice other than just saying 100%.
Let's go back a little bit. And again, I don't want to sound like the cliche podcast host who's trying to, you know, I really try to keep it different than other people, but this one piqued my interest a little bit. When you said before things can go wrong on these missions and shit starts to stack up, what kind of shit happens?
Go down the line of things that have gone wrong, to be honest with you. And I'll go into them. But I will say this: you know, over, you know, a 20-year career, and the majority of that within special operations. The bad times sucked. The tough nights were tough, but we learned the absolute most on missions that went wrong. Without a doubt, when things went right, we obviously, why would you change anything that you're doing? Cause things are just going right. But in hindsight, we found out there's a lot of times we just got lucky, and things went right, not because of how great we are, but because sometimes you just get lucky. So when things go wrong, pay attention, because that's when you're going to learn the absolute most. And I've prided myself my whole career not on being perfect. I've made so many mistakes. You wouldn't believe how many mistakes I've made, but I've always prided that I don't make the same mistake twice. And I don't care what profession you're in or what you do, you've got to live by that particular mindset that mistakes are okay, generally speaking, but you can never make the same mistake twice. We've made the mistake of giving out information to our partner force too early, having our partner force give up that information and walk right into a bomb that killed people, only to find out that it was our partner force was at the basis of that. So it's a tough lesson to learn. But it happens.
Were you able to take your mistakes and lessons learned to others to help ensure that they don't make the mistakes in the future?
Right after when I got out of the military, I contracted as a 1099 contractor with a company called Velocity Training. They had a lot of like special operation contracts. So I did a lot of training in CQB for the next generation of special operations, which is great because really, my experience, of combat from, 04, all the way to when I was in Syria to the late teens, no one else was getting actual combat experience, especially in that late in the game. And in Syria, we were the only ones doing offensive operations in Syria. So I've had, firsthand combat experience my whole career. And the truth is, on the white side or the non-tier one side, a lot of those guys, even though they're Green Berets that have gone overseas, they probably haven't conducted, or Navy SEALs, they haven't conducted a real world mission. And although they train for it a lot, it's not a hit on them. It's just a different time that they're in. So getting to give them all this real world experience, so they don't have to learn it the hard way that me and my teammates had to. And it's the same way with law enforcement. I've traveled around the country, working with various SWAT teams. And I'm never that guy that shows up. I'm like, hey, this is the way the Delta Force does it. And now this is how I expect you to do it. I show up, I see how they do business. And, when they ask, I say, well, this is how we do it. And I let them kind of pick and choose, what works for them and what doesn't, because I'll never pretend to that I did their job. I don't. There's so many other things that they have to take into account that I never had to. But there are a lot of things that cross over that I thoroughly enjoy sharing that knowledge with.
Never make the same mistake twice. Why do you think some people make the same mistake twice? Do you think it's the risk level of the mistake? And I'll tell you one thing that just comes to mind when I hear that, because I feel like I am some kind of like relationship mogul, and I watch people engage in dating the same person over and over again. And I don't mean the same person per se, the same person with the same name and identity. I'm saying the same person with the same bullshit bag of garbage that they got the last fucking person. So I guess that's really a psychology question right there, that on that sense. But why do you think that? Good.
I can answer that. Generally speaking, when it's things like that, like lifestyle choices, which is part of the don't make the same mistake twice, self-control. Just a lack of self-control. There's a real lack of either self-control or a lack of accountability, you know, in general in this country. And, you know, I'll take flack for this, but that's okay. I only know one way to say things, and that's just the truth. And how I feel, there's not a lot of self-control and accountability here. Cause if you continue to drink alcohol, it's not your fault. You know, you're an alcoholic. It's, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. You know, if you can't pay attention, it's not your fault. You have ADHD. I can go down the line. Nothing's anyone's fault. No one has self-control. That's why you make the same mistake twice, because you have no self-control. And the second part of that, when it comes to performance base, you're just not good enough. And so you couldn't meet the standard. And that's why you met, that's why you made the same mistake twice. And that's, I could probably package that nicer, but those are just the answers to the test.
Sometimes I like the idea that people don't have self-control and discipline, because it kind of lets the cream rise to the top a little bit easier. When you actually have self-control and self-discipline, it kind of really makes the playing ground of the game you look to play on a higher level very, very sparse. There's not many people who can play in high levels of discipline.
And it's, and you know, not to try to walk in it back or soften it up, but it's just the truth. And we live in a society where, you know, everyone gets a trophy and everyone should be able to do the job that they want to do. And that's just not true. So many people will just not be able to do certain things. You know, certain cops will just not be on the SWAT team, but that doesn't mean they're, you know, not good individuals. They just have to refocus and see what they are good at and find something else. But, you know, when it comes to the life and death world of tactics, there has to be a standard, and not everyone is going to get to wear the tab or the patch or get to play that game, because the risks are just too high.
A month ago, basketball season ended here, and my number two was waiting around at his last game. And I go, what are you waiting for? He goes, oh, they're going to give out trophies. And I looked at his coach, I go, you just got trophies for these guys? He goes, we don't have any trophies. And he goes, what do you mean there's no trophy? You got a trophy last year. I go, let's go. Get out of this fucking building as fast as possible. And I get in the car. He's like, I don't understand, Dad. Like, I wanted to get a trophy. I go, you didn't fucking win anything, dude.
Right.
Like, I have taken some of their stuff, and I'm like telling their mother, I'm like, don't let him take that. All he did was participate. Throw it in the fucking garbage. I passed my thoughts on to some of these coaches, like, listen, when you give out the fucking trophies, that's fine. My kids ain't getting them. Don't even make them for my kids. Save yourself the $15. I don't want these kids getting participation trophies, because that is not how life works. And you know what's crazy? People are fucking soft and they're like, oh, why would you say things like that? Listen, your kids can be whoever you're going to make them. I'm going to make my kids the way that I'm going to make them.
Right. And that's so my kids may not be, you know, basketball stars. That's fine. We'll go see what else you're good at, but I'm glad you got the experience. I'd love for them to experience all sorts of things. And I think it helps with that, rounding off, you know, them as a person. But yeah, you're not, it doesn't mean we're going to congratulate you as if you were successful to everything. It's part of the problem.
You ever feel like you're one of these very few souls on earth, kind of with brains? And like every so often you come across somebody with brains and common sense. You're like, oh, well, I didn't know there's anybody else here. This is great. It's nice to see you.
I felt more and more like that. I would say almost, last year, I'm not big on social media. I don't have a large circle of friends. I have my family and my business, and that's what I focus on. But yeah, that mentality was there. And you start thinking, am I the only one taking crazy? Am I taking crazy? Only one that thinks there's two genders? Am I the only one that thinks trans women shouldn't compete in women's sports? It's taken a little bit, but I think, you know, I think the common sense Americans have finally had enough, and it's good to see more and more people, you know, take a stance on it. And if I had to take a guess of why it happens, I think a lot of us were just like, this will pass. Like, this is crazy. Like, there's no way they're serious about this. And not only were they very serious about it, they got more serious about it. But I think it's about time, you know, that the other common sense grounded people on both sides of the aisle have had enough with it.
Hey guys, if you're enjoying the Street Cop Podcast, do us a favor and go give us a review on iTunes or Spotify, wherever you're listening to us. Tell a friend. We don't charge anything for the episodes. We appreciate your support. Check us out on any social platform by putting into the search bar Street Cop Training. Give us a follow. We have a lot of free content coming out every single day that you might not catch here on the podcast. And it's important for you to be able to do your job more professionally. And we also entertain you as well. Tell me about one of the most humiliating experiences, or humbling. I don't say humiliating. Humbling experiences of your life going through what you've been through.
No, you know, I'll tell this one, and I've never told this story publicly. I actually had to come back to Delta Force training twice. The first time I went, I got in trouble because I brought one of my Green Beret friends onto the compound, a top secret facility. Just brought a buddy on during the weekend and thought I could get away with it. It's a long story. The truth is, I did get away with it. And the only reason why I got caught was a neighbor's wife overheard a story of another wife talking about it. And it's just the wives network. And one of the wives' husband was an instructor and just was like, well, we'll see if that happened. So as they were calling people in to say, hey, they didn't even know who it was, nothing. They said, hey, did someone invite a friend onto the compound without permission? And I basically said, yeah, I did. And they were like amazed. Why are you that dumb to even admit that? Because they really didn't know who it was. There's a little more to the story. I believe they'd have found out who it was eventually. So just be a man, fess up. And so I got invited to leave and said, hey, come back when you grow up and you don't think it's okay to bring friends onto a top secret compound. And that is super embarrassing and humbling, because I had to go back to Special Forces after someone who got a chance to be at the greatest combat organization the world has ever seen. And I lost the chance because I invited a friend. It was the stupidest thing that could have ever happened. And you'd be like, why would you do that? Have a hard time explaining why I would do that to this day, but it happened and I didn't shy away from it. And I got kicked out and sent back to be a Green Beret. I did a deployment with that team, back to my old team, and had one of the greatest deployments of my career. Absolute greatest deployments of my career. We ran the commando mission out of the East, and we killed more bad guys than any other team in the country for that rotation. Saw a lot of action. I still talk to those guys to this day. I was fortunate enough to get a second chance and go back through training. And I made it the second time. And really the whole moral to that story is, and what I thought was the lowest point of my life of doing something so stupid, I lost my own dream job and I had no one to blame but myself, was the greatest thing that I wouldn't say the greatest. It was beneficial to me. I went back, had a great deployment. I still got to come back and carry out my dream. I learned a lot from it. I grew up a little bit. Before that, I was a little bit of I kind of do what I want guy. I grew up a little bit, and I was at the very end of the training course too. I mean, very end of it. And almost everyone, so I know I would have graduated. Everyone from that class went to one squadron. When I came back, I ended up getting assigned to a different squadron. And I'm so grateful that was the squadron I went to. And if it wasn't for that mess up, that I wouldn't have ended up with that squadron. The other thing it did is I was a little bit intolerant of other people's mistakes. And I would kind of crush people. Well, when you have that mistake in your background, it kind of makes you understand, hey, people make mistakes. And I was able to mentor other guys or new guys that made a mistake so big that they had to be released and told, hey, you can come back. If it was one of those decisions that you have to leave, but we'll let you back. And I was able to mentor those guys And I thought no one would ever forget about that. I thought I'd be the laughing stock of the unit my whole career. Yeah, you kind of build things up in your own mind that no one, that I would always be that guy who let a friend out on the compound. No one knew I did that. Nobody knew I did that, you know, about 8 years into work there. And when new guys would make mistakes, so I would have to leave. I'd tell them the same story. And I would say, hey, did you ever hear about the story? We're a very small unit. So stories, everyone knows the stories. They get told over and over. So did you ever hear the story of the guy in OTC that let a friend onto the compound? They're like, yeah, it's actually now during the in brief. When you in brief, you get told, don't be like this idiot who brought a friend onto the compound. It's like, yeah, we heard that story in training. I said, well, that was me. And they're like, no way. I've worked with you for 2 years. Had no idea that was you. Yep. And look at me. Yep. I've been here for almost a decade now. You can overcome this. Go grow up. Come back. Take your lickings. Life has a weird way of working out. And almost every mistake that I perceived as either a mistake or a move that I thought was bad, you know, in my career, I got moved to another team or something I didn't like. As a 40-something-year-old, when I look back at that in the long picture, every single one of those things worked out for me. But I didn't let them overwhelm me and crush me as a person. As long as you learn from it and come back and use that as motivation to be stronger or better, they can be blessings in disguise. And that's what they ended up for me.
You're like, being that mentor is exactly what you were supposed to do with it. And the story's kind of similar here, where I tell guys in class, I'm like, guys, I've made every mistake on duty and off duty. I've done it all. And, you know, I'm here today to tell you that here's why it happened and here's how to avoid it happening to you, because I'm going to save you so much trouble in the long run. Because nobody ever put their arm around me as a younger cop and said, hey, here's some advice moving forward. They just didn't. And there was 200 people I worked with at an agency, but nobody cared enough to say that. And I probably wasn't mature enough to give that advice until I was in my 30s, to be quite honest with you, because yes, I wasn't an example of that advice.
Same here.
But you know, most of my life is this stoic thing where I'm really trying to give people advice of the hardships I've been through and how it could help them. And kind of this podcast is about that. And dude, I got to tell you, I'm so thankful that you shared that today, because what a gift to the world you've given everybody who probably have a hard time admitting to shit themselves. But, no, you know, it not only did it speak volumes of your character then and the integrity for you to say, yeah, that was me, well, you didn't have to say that, which I'm sure everybody listening to this podcast got just a whole new wave of respect for it. Not that they didn't have enough to begin with, but Jesus Christ, now you're like, forget it. But then on top of it, to use that for the betterment of others. It's very interesting. My humbling story is not even close to that. Mine's a more recent one. I guess at times you think that you're, well, I don't think I'm hot shit. I try to have small celebrations. And I guess in the context of some things, we tend to think we're hot shit a little bit until you meet motherfuckers that are way more hot shit than you are. So just so we're clear, everybody who's out there, one of the best things you can do is continue to deploy as much humility as you possibly can, because just when you think you're the hottest shit around, motherfuckers show up and they're just way more hotter shit than you are. And I got to tell you, dude, not to celebrate our wins and you know, things are exciting. I think I get more excited about things at times, but man, there's certainly a counterbalance to having success, and it only takes a little bit to get you chopped right that back down to size where you belong, but also it gives you perspective where you have to go as well. So, and I guess the correlation to that is I joined a mastermind group, and the price to join is not an easy one to swallow. And I'm very much into investing into my growth, in turn, everybody else's growth. And when you understand that process, which I'm sure you do, your business guy, you'll get what I'm saying. Some people say, what does that mean? Well, it means that if I learn how to do this better, that means it's better for everybody else as well. That's what I'm trying to do. And that's on every level of running this company and being the person you need me to be. And I went to the first event with those folks. And some of them, I think, were a little peacocky and trying to show off a little bit at the beginning. And some of them weren't. And what I found out was the ones who weren't were just way more wealthy than I was. I mean, like, and I'm not even that, like, dude, I'm comfortable. Motherfuckers ripping, you know, $8 million a month net to the neck. Yeah, like, yeah, dude, right? And you're just like, I'm doing good. I bought a hot tub, right? And like, not only did I get a hot tub, I got a big ass one and it was expensive. Yeah. And like, you know, like I didn't get the 80,000, you know, but like, you know, you're spending like money on a hot, you're like, damn, I'm doing all right. Right. And then people like, so confirm that they're like, your hot tub is awesome. And like the backyard's cool. And I'm like, thank you, because I'm having some. And then you meet people who are like, yeah, I did 900K this month. And I'm like, yeah, like your whole company. And they're like, no. Like, that's what I took home after EBITDA and all that shit. I'm like, what? Right. Yeah. I'm like, what? So like, it's not about the money. It's about knowing that you ain't the only motherfucker out there, and people out there are doing it way better than you are as well. And that's okay. Just don't pretend like you're the best there's ever been. And as long as you can hold on to that. And I say that because I can think about cops who are like at their agencies and probably good at what they do. So they're good at going out in the streets and fucking catching bad guys and might have some real cockiness with them, but the real power is in the humility behind that and not taking that and saying, I'm the best there ever was or the best there's ever been. In your small circle of people, you can guys goof around with that. But constant humility is something people really admire.
So I was especially as a 27-year-old Green Beret, I was a very cocky person, but I wasn't the best Green Beret in my company. I wasn't there. I knew for a fact there was better guys than me, and I never claimed to be the best. I just always knew I was better than most of them. I didn't think I was the best, but I wasn't scared to tell the ones I was better at that I was better than them, and then prove it. But my point is, the guys who were better than me didn't go to the Delta Force. I did. Why is that? I don't know. One of the reasons I know is because I went to selection. The other two did not. Or three, however many, you know, there were that were better than me. And I don't know. And I know they wanted to, but at the end of the day, sometimes there's something that comes along with cockiness that they won't. Well, you can't be overly cocky. If you're so cocky that you're not willing to fail in front of other people because of your ego, then you'll never, you know, meet your whole potential either. So you can be as cocky as you want, but stay cocky in on a small department, or, you know, I'm not making fun of small departments, but stay cocky and not go out for the SWAT team. And just believe that you could have always made it rather than prove it or disprove it by going. And so I don't have a problem with ego and cockiness. I think it drives people to be better, generally speaking. But sometimes when it's at a level that you won't go take a risk to advance your career because you're scared of failure, then that's when I have an issue with it.
Well, I think people have a real big misunderstanding of ego versus conceit. I think ego is a very healthy thing to have. And people often misunderstand me at times, especially if you have no context of who I am. Obviously I'm much more displaying humility at this point in my life, but sometimes I'm not, dude, right? I'm like, and the next day I'm like, oh, that's kind of like dicky of me to like fucking say and do, and I don't know why I go that route sometimes. And I typically try to like make sure in the future I don't do that again, because I'm just a human being and I make mistakes. But you know, I'm also not conceited by any stretch of the imagination. But I have ego because I have confidence, and people get my confidence confused with conceit.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's the drive, you know, the hunger. One of the things I would say that, I fear the most, I'm very aware of, concerned with, is, the possibility of not being successful in business and then finding out that I was only good at one thing in life. And I should have just stuck to killing people in the middle of the night because I'm not good at anything else. And so there's a healthy amount of fear as well. There's a healthy amount of confidence. There's a healthy amount of fear that both keep you on the right track. And that fear of failure has me putting in 13-hour days. At least 6 days a week. I try to take Sundays off, but the truth is I'm probably going to crack open the computer, write a couple emails, and make sure I'm ready for Monday. But there's, you know, we talked about fear a little bit, you know, controlling you. But there is also a healthy fear as well, and it drives you to success.
You know, it's again, there is obviously much more deep-rooted shit. And, you know, as the podcast gets bigger, I get emails and messages like, I have to disagree with what you said in episode 738. At 1643, you said this about transgender athletes. And I'm like, I don't fuck. Like, guys, I'm just trying to do my best.
Does it bother you? Do you go to the comments and see?
I don't give a fuck.
Emails?
You could fucking stand on hilltops and scream megaphones that you don't like me. I honestly don't give a fuck. So don't even waste your time. I just don't care. I can't emphasize it enough. And I'm not saying this from some weird place. I have learned a long time ago to stop giving a fuck about people who are doing nothing with their lives and who's literally, and bro, it's crazy. It sounds even in this profession with special forces and military and police and fire and first responders, there's so many goddamn keyboard warriors, not just dorks in their basements. It's fucking keyboard warrior first responders, all fucking tough guys.
Yeah.
All fucking tough guys. All of them. It's fucking nuts. And dude, like, I don't feed into it, but dude, it's like, it's disheartening to see that these guys and girls are like, you're such in a bad place. You're going to take time out of your day to criticize some of the work that we're doing.
Right.
Like, then guess what? Don't even look at us. Like, just don't even look. It's okay. Right. Don't. Yeah. I just had a guy said something to me about, podcast that I did recently. And I said, hey man, I appreciate your attention for as long as we've had it. I'll take this message as a signal that you will not be with us anymore. And I hope that you stay safe out there, my man. And I rarely recomment, but I was still very, very nice about it. I really meant it. Like, dude, I'm sorry that one episode out of 812 did not meet your liking.
Right.
Cool shit. I'm sorry that that this bothered you. You know, there's no acknowledgement for the other 811 episodes. So if I can't help you, maybe your therapist can.
Yeah. I try to look at most of them. I don't want to, you know, disappoint anyone, but you're right. You're not going to please everyone.
No,
but some people just give the most of the comments. And I don't mind it if it's a comment that's, you know, generally either something they don't believe in that you said, or it's some sort of constructive. Case in point, I think a couple days ago, we made a post and it said something about coffee being the most natural pre-workout energy drink that you could consume, which is not, it's a factual statement. And the guy says, oh, exactly what I want to do when I work out, have to take a big dump. And so just the most useless comment ever. I don't even know like what is. And so I wrote back. I said, just what I want to do when I'm squatting is need to take a massive dump. I don't normally personally get on and jab back and forth with people. So I immediately wrote him and I said, well, thanks for letting us all know that your digestive system is probably as weak as your squats. And the guy writes back. I was like, well, we lost that customer. But the guy writes back. He has no idea who I am or my history or anything. And he just goes, oh, my gosh. I never thought I'd get smacked down by a coffee company that hard. And he just laughed. He goes, I'm sorry. Now that I think about it, that was a really jerk thing to say. You guys have a great one.
I think he's a customer for life, dude.
Yeah, customer for life. Yeah.
Yeah. That's fucking amazing. Well,
they
don't
always end that way, but every now and again they do.
Yeah. Listen, dude, honestly, I've had people apologize to me on many occasions. And I think people have, you know, I've earned people's trust at this point. And I have owned anything that I did that was not correct, or if I've ever misbehaved, I've apologized to people. It's very rare. I really try to employ a lot of thought before I do anything. And actually, it becomes very natural now. But I actually, yesterday was approving, we have a Facebook group with 100,000 cops, and they'll pose questions, and then I prove which ones are important. And just so you guys know, if you are posting in the group and you are trying to recruit people for your agency, and there's 19 people write to me like, hey, I put like training flyers up and like that we're hiring at our company. And I'm like, yeah, you guys and 1600 other fucking people. I try to pick which ones we haven't done yet. I try to keep the feed interesting. Well, anyway, yesterday a guy put a question up about a domestic violence incident that occurred and he thought this was his opinion. And I prefaced it by saying, I am in no way trying to sound like a dickhead. I just want you to understand that before I ask these questions. Because these questions will sound like I'm being a dickhead. Yeah. And then I said what I said. I said, you know, where are you formulating your opinion from? What cases are you citing that make you believe that this was not an exigent circumstance? And his response back to me was, I would never think you're a dickhead. You didn't even have to say that. And that just told me that, you know, that guy has given us his trust where he can show up vulnerable and know that somebody with compassion is going to help him and help him better assess future situations. And he doesn't have to come here with his head getting fucking sliced off because it was an infantile question. I remind some of these older guys, we were all new once.
Yeah.
I don't know when you fucking forgot that we were all new once. I got 22 years in this profession. You've got 17, you've got 15. How dare you talk to the 2001, 2003 you in the way you just did? Imagine if you were that guy at that time, you would have been crushed. Why are you doing that? And that's why they come here, because they know that our arms are wide open. We just are.
And it's funny you say that. I've reminded several senior operators that same thing. But I also will say, I don't agree with the term, there's no stupid questions. Of course there are. I've fielded a bunch of stupid questions, but not all. But yeah, you know, that's not the, you know, the general consensus. A lot of people that, you know, that ask questions and I go, man, there's no other way he would know other than to ask this question. There's a lot of people that ask questions that have no business asking questions. Like that's a Google search away, or sometimes I call it, that's a look at me question. You know, pay attention to me. I'm engaging and asking questions. That, come on, ask a decent question.
You know, man, we're just trying to do our best. And I think tomorrow's always a new opportunity to reinvent yourself and be a better human being than you could be the day before. And Brent, it's fucking awesome to meet you, bro. I can't wait to fucking hang out with you in 3 weeks and chop it up and shoot the shit. And hopefully we can get together and do some Nashville shit together.
I'll be down there looking to hang out with you for sure and have a good time.
Yeah, we're gonna have a good time, bro. A lot of cool people coming. And it's going to be good. So, dude, it's great. And appreciate you being here today, taking the time out. It was a really good episode.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I enjoyed talking to you. It was really just like sitting around and just talking back and forth and didn't feel much like an interview. It was real comfortable. I appreciate it.
I'm one of them motherfuckers. I'm one of them guys. Oh, wait, hold on a second. What do you want to promote? Promote your shit. My bad.
I'd as much as I'd love to promote my stuff, more importantly right now, I touched on it earlier. We call it Coffee with a Purpose, and sometimes it's not all about the coffee. Mike Lumberstadt just passed away, an Orange County SWAT guy. We've already donated to it. We'll continue to donate to it. Please go to frccoffee.com. We have a donate link at the very bottom, and why that's important is because we don't, unlike GoFundMe, 100% of everything that goes to our donations, which is a 501c3 nonprofit, is where that gets donated to. Our nonprofit goes to that family. So the one thing I want to talk about is Mike and what an amazing man he was, a husband, a father of three small children. He passed away. And that's what I want to talk about. Please go to our website, donate to that, and it will go right to his family. We'll talk coffee a little time.
Off-duty training accident, right? Something like that.
Yeah, yeah. He was doing hand-to-hand training, and he had gone home, and his head just didn't feel right. I ended up checking into a hospital, and ended up having what we believe is more likely an aneurysm or an internal brain bleed. And as they went to try to correct it, things just went south and went south in a hurry. So it's sometimes even worse when it's one of those incidents that makes no sense. I've been there. I've lost guys on training accidents in the real world. And it, oddly enough, sometimes easier to take a real world mission accident because you know the risk everyone's taken. And sometimes those training kind of senseless incidents are the hardest to digest. So the boys are hurting, the SWAT guys are hurting, the department's hurting, the family's hurting, and that's what I'd like to talk about. Like I said, we'll talk coffee at a later time.
Yeah, that GoFundMe is up on our page as well.
Yeah, go anywhere, please.
Yeah. So I think I've already donated to that. This is not a brag, just to set an example of, you know, we certainly try to do the best that we can in our part on making sure that these, and we got a lot of stuff in the works for us as well on R513C. Hopefully this year we'll get that all worked out, but a lot of good people behind that. And the craziest thing is it's guys who were shot that are putting it together and for these families. So it's, I guess the world is entitled to receive help when they need it. And I'm glad that so many people like yourself and the men and women in the Street Cop Survivors Club stepping up to the plate and all pitching in. One of the guys, Danny Coyle, just came here the other day and dropped off from about an hour and a half away all the raffle prizes they'll be raffling off at our conference. So he just on his own time. These guys are doing a great job. They're getting a lot of donations and shit like that. So it's super cool. But yeah, man, we're on that. And anything you need from us, always available.
And I just have to say this: when you go to the GoFundMe, you'll see, you know, maybe up to $150,000 donated, and say they're good. I just have to remind you, he was the sole breadwinner for the family. And $150,000 does not go far when you know that's 2 years of work for the guy. And his kids have a lifetime of needs that are going to come around. So continue to give regardless of whether you think they've been helped enough or not. I assure you they have not been.
All right. On that note, we'll be wrapping this up. Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at streetcop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out streetcop.com for that offer.